Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, when Oscar Niemeyer and Lúcio Costa designed Brazil's capital, the city of Brasilia, their detailed plans did not include where to put food waste and other garbage. The answer was the Estrutural garbage dump, which opened 67 years ago. The dump is just 20 kilometers from the presidential palace in Brasilia. It has become the biggest landfill in Latin America. But on January 19th, the dump was closed. Governor Rodrigo Hollenberg opened a new landfill further outside the city as a replacement. The move has angered thousands of scavengers who make a living from the garbage. They go through the waste and take what they believe is worth saving. At the opening of the new landfill, the governor said, "We cannot live with this open wound in the midst of our nation's capital, a dump where human beings put their lives at risk seeking a livelihood in an undignified way." Since Brasilia was founded in 1960, it has grown to become the nation's fourth largest city. It is home to about 2.5 million people. For years, thousands of poor people searched through the Estrutural dump for cans, copper wire, or anything else that could be used or sold. Generations of garbage pickers brought their children to work in the smelly, dirty landfill. Hollenberg's plan is to employ the scavengers at new recycling centers where the garbage can be separated in cleaner conditions. But people working in the old dump on its last day said they refuse to trade their source of earnings for government jobs that pay too little to support their families. "I'll have to start working the streets looking through garbage cans," said Ivan de Souza. He worked at the landfill every day for 5 years. Souza told the Reuters news agency that in a good month, he could earn about $937. That is more than three times the lowest wages permitted under Brazilian law. Souza told Reuters he was thinking of returning to his home state of Maranhão in northeast Brazil. Environmentalists made a strong case for closing the old garbage dump. They warned that it was polluting Brasilia's water supply. The city has already been forced to limit use of water supplies because of extremely dry weather. Brasilia is home to many well-paid government employees. Its many wealthy households produce a lot of garbage. More than 1,200 tons of garbage were left every day at the old landfill. Its closure will affect families living in a nearby community called Cidade Estrutural. Set up by garbage pickers, the community is home to an estimated 40,000 people. Many will have a hard time finding other jobs as Brazil slowly rises out of its worst recession in years. Some members of the garbage pickers said they would rather stay working in the old dump than have the cost of a long trip to and from the new recycling centers. Valgia Dutra, another scavenger, also spoke with Reuters. Dutra said he has searched through the dump's garbage for 16 years. He said, "Hollenberg hasn't offered us a real alternative. We cannot survive on that pay."
The Lunar New Year, also known as the Chinese New Year, begins on February 16th. 2018 is the year of the dog. But in Malaysia, some businesses are avoiding dog symbols in their decorations. They do not want to insult the country's Muslim majority. Islamic tradition considers dogs unclean. Muslims are required to wash themselves if they touch the animal. Malaysia is a nation of several religions and cultures. But there has been a growing rejection of activities considered insulting to Islam. In recent years, this has become evident in demonstrations against music shows and celebrations that involve alcohol. Muslims make up about 61% of the 32 million Malaysians. About 20% of the population is Buddhist, making Buddhism the second largest religion in Malaysia. Pavilion Kuala Lumpur is a shopping center in the Bukit Bintang area of the capital. It is popular with foreign visitors. This year, the center has not included dog imagery in Lunar New Year decorations. Instead, the decorations honor the center's 10th anniversary. Kung Swan Ai is the director of marketing for Pavilion Kuala Lumpur. She said religious and cultural sensitivities influenced the decoration choices. The shopping center attracts 3 million people of many cultures each month, she said. She said Pavilion Kuala Lumpur considered decorations that would make all people feel accepted. 12 animals make up the traditional Chinese zodiac. It includes dogs and pigs, another animal which Muslims consider unclean. Malaysian Muslim leaders have spoken out about other events that involve dogs. At the 2014 Commonwealth Games opening ceremony in Glasgow, Scotland, athletes paraded with a Scottish terrier dog. After the event, Malaysian politicians expressed their disapproval, calling the act disrespectful. In 2016, Malaysian religious officials asked an international fast food restaurant to change the name of a food it sold in Malaysia. Auntie Anne's sold an item called a pretzel dog. The religious officials wanted it to be renamed pretzel sausage. They said pretzel dog confused Muslims who are not permitted to eat dog meat. My town is another Kuala Lumpur shopping center where half the visitors are Muslim. This year, it has made its Lunar New Year decorations more moderate. Christopher Ka is head of marketing for my town. He said the dogs are not the central object on display. He said they do not appear as objects of worship. For this same reason, he said, many Malaysian businesses also no longer display a large pig to honor the year of the boar. Alex Chow runs a company that makes packaging materials. He said that his large business clients have chosen very general imagery for their packaging designs this year. But some Malaysians are not happy about these changes. Wang Wei-shen, an ethnic Chinese, has several dogs as pets. She said businesses were being ridiculous. It's a shame because Malaysia is a multicultural country. To dismiss the fact that the Chinese have a dog as one of the zodiac animals is unfair, said Wang. She said that every zodiac animal has good qualities, and the dog represents a guide, a best friend, a comforter and loyal friend. I'm Alice Bryant.
United States government agencies say the first tests of a very small nuclear power system designed for missions to Mars have been successful. The American Space Agency, NASA, and the Department of Energy recently announced the results in Las Vegas, Nevada. The officials said they will carry out a full test of the system in March. The project to design a small nuclear fission system is called Kilopower. Testing began last November at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site. The goal is to provide energy for future missions in space and possibly on the surface of Mars and other planets in our solar system. NASA astronauts visited the surface of Earth's moon six times between 1969 and 1972. But establishing a long-term colony on the surface of the moon or another planet is more difficult. Such missions need a power source strong enough to support a base, but small and light enough for transport through space. Steve Jerzyk is the Associate Administrator of NASA's Space Technology Mission Directorate. He told the Reuters News Service that the Martian environment presents problems. He said, "Mars is a very difficult environment for power systems, with less sunlight than Earth or the Moon, very cold nighttime temperatures, very interesting dust storms that can last weeks and months that engulf the entire planet." He said that Kilopower's small size and strength make it possible to transport several of the systems on a single landing vehicle. They would then be able to provide a colony or base with tens of kilowatts of power. Lee Mason is NASA's expert on power and energy storage. He said Mars has been the main goal of the Kilopower project. He also noted that a human mission to Mars likely would require 40 to 50 kilowatts of power. Dave Poston is the chief reactor designer at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He said that testing on parts of the system have been greatly successful. "The models have predicted very well what has happened, and operations have gone smoothly," he noted. NASA's test design of the nuclear power system uses a reactor core made of the substance uranium-235. The core is about the size of a roll of paper towels. The technology could power life support systems for people. It could help astronauts mine for resources, recharge vehicles, and run equipment, Some equipment could change things such as ice on the planet into oxygen, water, and fuel. Experts think kilopower could also possibly improve electrically powered spacecraft engines on missions to the outer planets of our solar system. I'm Pete Musto.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their ninth president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president. He's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator, he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, but after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass, that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea, but he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.